American Cassette Ministries takes great pride in presenting Dr. Agatha Thrash, one of America's foremost lecturers and authors on the subject of alternative preventative medicine. Prior to entering the field of preventative medicine, Dr. Agatha Thrash, a physician, practiced pathology for 15 years. Her husband, Calvin, also a physician, practiced internal medicine for 20 years. The doctors Thrash co-founded UT Pines Institute, a medical missionary training center in Seale, Alabama, and have authored various books, including Home Remedies, Nutrition for Vegetarians, Natural Remedies, The Animal Connection, and Eat for Strength, a vegetarian cookbook. Dr. Agatha Thrash has appeared on television and radio interviews and has lectured throughout the United States and Canada, as well as in Norway, Puerto Rico, Bermuda, and the Orient. And now, Dr. Agatha Thrash, in another excellent presentation designed to help you live a happier, healthier, and longer life.
Good evening. We are certainly very happy to be in your area as a guest in your church. We hope the material that we cover tonight will be of great importance to you, great interest, and a great deal of help. I'd like to just mention the fact that we are seeing a new day in the treatment of diseases. Not only are we treating diseases more and more with simple remedies, but we're also treating diseases more and more with very serious and dangerous drugs. So we're seeing two types of things come about in American medicine these days. And it's an interesting phenomenon to live in these times. I'm very thankful that I have the opportunity to live in this age of Earth's history. I'm glad that I can see this development in the along lines of natural healing, that has to do with the brain hormones and how we turn on our internal mechanisms of healing. All of this has come up in the last 10 years. I'm thankful that I can be a part of this scene. Not that I have had to do with initiating any of the information that we now know concerning the treatment with simple remedies. This is being done at many of the large universities of our land, like Sloan Kettering and Northwestern and Berkeley and other places. But I can witness it and be a part of it. To me, it's exciting to be a part of this kind of work. There are alternative methods of practice being promoted by some doctors like Dr. Robert Mendelsohn. Some of you have doubtless heard of him. He wrote a book called Confessions of a Medical Heretic. This book brought him under some fire with the medical profession because of the fact that it is indeed, he does present it as a medical heretic. He talks about the holy waters of medicine, those things that are used that have sort of placebo effect, or that are used because of our traditions. This is a fact in medicine. We do use a lot of drugs that have a short lifespan. The average drug has a lifespan of a mere 5 years. And at the end of that time, that drug is discarded, generally called worthless and dangerous, or words to that effect. Then that drug is dropped, and another drug has another lifespan of 5 years, is brought in to replace it, and at the end of that time, it bears the same label. And we repeat this kind of thing over and over. And Dr. Robert Mendelson talks about that. Some of you may have heard, may have read his little newsletter called The People's Doctor, or you may have read his newspaper column. In his column, he answers questions on a wide variety of topics. The reason that I mention his name is just to illustrate the fact that he is one among many physicians today who have become interested in treating disease in other ways than that of the established way. Also, he has done quite a great service to help women, mothers, be willing to take responsibility for the treatment of their own children. He himself, a pediatrician, understands many of the fears and trials that mothers go through in trying to take responsibility for their own children's health. And he has some very good counsel for mothers in this way. Not only are physicians like this man and several others who are becoming more or less famous in the United States, famous for their counsel to do simple remedies and to avoid the remedies that are known to be harmful. Not only that, but there are also many in the media, in television, radio, newspapers, news magazines, and also this new movement that has come up of health magazines, health journals. A plethora of health journals have come out in the last 10 years, beginning before that with Prevention magazine, and then going right on through to the present time with a large number of health magazines. These magazines have encouraged people to take responsibility for their own health. This is being done not only in the way of treatment of disease, but is also being done in the way of maintenance of health. Those two things we should separate. The treatment of disease is not the same as maintenance of health. When we treat disease, we want a certain response from the body. Therefore, we should not be putting the body to the same tax that we will be that we expect the body to respond in the way that we expect the body to respond when we are sick, that we should do when we are just maintaining health. To give you an example, many people feel that they should take a hot and cold shower every morning. This is a maintenance shower, they think. But it is not a maintenance shower. If it is hot and cold, it is a treatment bath. This kind of bath should be reserved for the time that we are actually sick. And every morning we should take a cool bath or a lukewarm bath followed by a brisk rub down with a dry towel to wipe off or rub off the excess dead skin that we have on the skin all the time and to stimulate the skin so that the skin will produce its own oily substances and also protect itself against fungus diseases and eczema and things of this nature. So we should make a distinction between treatment of disease and the maintenance of health. Now, in the maintenance of health, we have nutrition, exercise, fresh air, but we also use those in the treatment of disease. But the application of these to treat disease is often quite different than the application to maintain health. In Maclean's magazine, which some of you are doubtless familiar with, it is the Canadian news magazine, very similar to Time and Life and Newsweek. In this magazine, Sidney Katz has some very interesting things to say about Seventh-day Adventists. I will quote some things from McLean's. He says, I've got some advice on how to improve the health of Canadians and at the same time lop billions of dollars off our annual health costs. Canadians are very interested in that these days. I think we should study the lifestyle of adherents of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and then explore ways and means of persuading the public to emulate the Adventists. Well, I like that so far, don't you? I think that if you can convince people that that we have been preaching for over 100 years in the line of health reform, if we could teach all of Canada, persuade all of Canada to follow that, Canada would probably become a very wealthy neighbor to our north and could be a help to us in our own financial crunch that we are going through. I'll skip some and continue reading. In my opinion, the Adventists provide a way out of our current health dilemma of skyrocketing health costs without an appreciable improvement in the nation's health. Well, that too sounds familiar, doesn't it? And very desirable. Our own skyrocketing costs, but not skyrocketing health. In fact, our health is going in the opposite direction from the costs. As the costs go up, our health goes down. To continue reading, also, Adventists have discredited the belief that the public level of health can be raised by buying more drugs, more surgery, more hospitalizations, more diagnostic procedures, and more doctor services. Adventists offer proof that less is more. The Adventist secret of good health at bargain rates stems from a cardinal teaching of their church. Every Adventist must commit himself to a lifestyle that promotes physical well-being. Well, as a physician, I would smile at that one, wouldn't you? It isn't every Adventist who has committed himself to a lifestyle that will promote physical well-being. But Mr. Katz thinks that we do, so we want to make his thoughts come true. Every Adventist should commit himself to a lifestyle that will promote good health. And I hope that after tonight, you will go home with a refreshed commitment to commit yourself to a lifestyle that promotes physical well-being. Let me continue. Neglect or abuse of the body is immoral, says Mr. Katz. The Adventist takes an oath to abstain from alcohol and tobacco and is encouraged to exercise regularly, to get sufficient sleep, to keep weight down, and not to overindulge in the consumption of meat. A high proportion of Adventists, in fact, are vegetarians. The church takes a hard, unswerving line on health habits. I wish that one were true, don't you? Hard and unswerving is what Mr. Katz says we have in the way of line on health habits. If you break the more important rules, you're kicked out. There's a down-to-earth explanation for this uncompromising stance, according to a prominent Adventist pastor I talked to recently. Quote, we Adventists believe we were placed on earth to serve God and our fellow men. Amen. You can't accomplish your mission if you're physically unfit. You slouch around tired, grouchy, and probably hostile. What we want are upbeat people brimming with energy, enough energy to love and help others. And I would like to add to what the Adventist pastor says, we need to have enough energy to pray and to read our Bibles. That requires more energy than any other mental activity. To pray puts us in a different kind of mental gear, and I'll be talking about that tomorrow night. This mental gear is difficult to maintain with electrical output of the brain. And most people, to be very frank, do not have enough energy left over from such things as making order out of the chaos of their digestive problems, or trying to keep up their energy from lack of physical conditioning. The heart and lungs are not in good enough condition to utilize properly oxygen and water and nutrients and other things, and so many people simply don't have enough energy left over to pray. Consequently, they never do. They don't commune with our Heavenly Father. And angels, so we are told, marvel that we pray so little. It is because we don't have energy. Let me continue with what Mr. Katz says. The longevity of the faithful is also reflected in the obituary columns of the fortnightly periodical, The Canadian Adventist Messenger. And then he lists four individuals who have died in Canada just very recently, recent to the time that he was making this report. One was at age 90, another at age 93, and two more at age 90. So that seems to indicate that living healthfully will certainly help you to live longer. Living healthfully and living a strongly religious life also helps you to live more healthfully if you're in an accident, if you're operated on, if you have an illness, or if you have childbirth. From each one of these, if you are deeply religious, you will be able to recover from your accident or illness or surgery faster than if you were not religious. Studies show that those who have a deep religious faith get sick less often, and when they are sick, they get well sooner than do those who are not religious. I wish I could read the whole article for you. It certainly is a fine article. Let me just skip some and go on to a couple of other sentences that he says. A lesson to be learned from the Adventists is that we must assume the responsibility ourselves for keeping happy, for keeping healthy. Adventists, along with everyone else, are undergoing this change in our own responsible feelings. We now feel more responsible for our health than we have in the recent past. There was a time when everybody sort of took the body down to the doctor once a year for the annual checkup. That was somewhat similar to the way that they took their car down for the 5,000-mile checkup, so almost exactly the same kind of thing. And the doctor, just like the mechanic, told you what was wrong and told you what to do and assumed the responsibility for anything that might be defective in the body. Adventists, along with everybody else, are now understanding that responsibility for the health rests squarely on one's own shoulders. And then the last sentence is this: Hippocrates, the father of medicine, taught that a prudent lifestyle was the royal road to good health. In recent years, the spectacular discoveries of scientific medicine have overshadowed the precepts of Hippocrates. Yet, for all its dazzling promise, scientific medicine has failed miserably to usher in a disease-free society. With these thoughts, we have two things. One is that it is less expensive and more helpful for us to live in the Adventist's lifestyle. Secondly, that modern medicine, with all its dazzling promise, is not delivering good health. So if we plan to be healthy, we must do so through a proper lifestyle. Now, if you will take the book that you have in your hand called Nutrition for Vegetarians, this book will be, the book that you have will be on sale after our meeting, but we wanted you to have it in front of you during the meeting so that you can follow along as I talk to you. You can just leave it on your pew when the meeting is over. If you'll turn to page 1, you will see the beginning of a chapter called Why Be a Vegetarian? And I would like to discuss this matter with you briefly. Chapters upon chapters could have been written about this subject, and we could have a whole seminar on no other topic other than this. Why be a vegetarian? But we will briefly cover this topic in the next few minutes. Notice on page 1, cosmetic reasons are listed for being vegetarian. Those who are familiar with the vegetarian lifestyle have understood that they show their age less readily. They also get about with greater nimbleness for a longer period of time if they follow the vegetarian lifestyle. And many people who are in the entertainment world and others who make their living by their faces enjoy the fact that they show their age less readily if they're vegetarians. Then the next reason is that of religious reasons. Millions of people the world over have such religious ideas as the transmigration of the soul. This includes many Indians, East Indians, who would not kill a cow because of their belief in the transmigration of the soul. The Vegan Society, the members of this society, for humanitarian reasons, will not kill or even keep animals. They feel that animals, even bees, should not be kept in any kind of artificial environment. They won't eat honey in protest to bees being kept in hives. They will not use any kind of animal flesh or animal product in protest to that idea of keeping or using animals in any way. Now, the next reason listed is that of economic reasons. I certainly like this about the vegetarian fare. The month that we became vegetarians in our home, we cut our food bill to about 60%, or down to 60% of what we had spent before, and I have thoroughly enjoyed that part. But the real reason that we became vegetarians in our home had to do with health reasons. You will see that the length of life before the flood was much greater when mankind was on a vegetarian diet. Then, you will see on page 2 that this diet is an historically reliable diet. People have lived on vegetarian diets for millennia, quite successfully. They have reproduced themselves very easily. They have also lived to a ripe old age. Their children have been healthy. This all on a vegetarian diet. On page 2, under a section labeled Health Reasons, you will see a little discussion of the Chinese coolie, who is a small fellow, but even so, he can draw a load of freight at a speed of the horse's trot for a distance of 30 to 40 miles at a time. His diet consists of rice, dates, and vegetables. Very rarely, he may have a small portion of fish, but that's unusual. The Hindu messengers who carried dispatches long distances day after day live principally on rice. The Irish peasant, who ranks among the most active of men, subsists chiefly on potatoes, buttermilk, and simply cooked vegetables. The native Andean Indian, after carrying on his shoulders burdens of 200 pounds, is able to do a day's work of far greater magnitude than most of our ordinary laborers. His food is largely bananas and wholemeal bread or cereals. Now, not only are these proverbial and very famous individuals largely vegetarians, for all of these, less than 5% of their daily intake comes from any substance from the animal kingdom, meat, milk, eggs, cheese, or honey. But for us, our blood chemistries can be easily shown to be much better if we do not use animal products. Blood chemistries would be such things as blood sugar, which you may find on your laboratory sheet as blood glucose, cholesterol, triglycerides, blood urea nitrogen, which is a urinary tract waste, all of these and several others, sodium, chloride, these all tend to go up as we get older. There isn't any kind of blood chemistry that tends to go down as we get older. All of them tend to go up. In other words, there is an accumulation of nutrients in the blood as we get older. This accumulation of nutrients can be regarded as a sign of aging. If these are signs of aging, then would there be a way, by the control of the diet, that we could help these nutrients not to go up, these nutrients and waste products not to accumulate in the blood? And the answer is that we can, to some degree, prevent the aging that we see in the blood chemistries by the continual elevation of blood chemistries through our years. This can be done by reducing our total food intake. It can also be done by a vegetarian diet. These two ways are the best two ways to assist in this thing of the control of the blood chemistries. Now, so far as the blood chemistries are concerned, our very best control would be that of the reduction in our food. So far as animal studies are concerned, we can reduce the mortality rate of animals by reducing their food intake to about a third of what they would take if they just ate whatever they wanted to throughout their lifetimes. They live on and on, a third longer, if we just reduce their food intake. Humans do the same. Cancer, as an example, one-third of individuals who have cancer have an association of their cancer with overeating. Overeating becomes then a threat to our lives, threat to longevity, a risk in getting cancer. It is also a risk in arthritis, in heart disease, and a number of other diseases where just simply overeating is a problem for the body. On page 3, you will see a section on the Daily Food Guide. Notice that this guide is prepared by the National Dairy Council and tells you exactly what you might feel that the Dairy Council would suggest that people use. Some milk for everyone is the motto of the National Dairy Council. But there are some people whose health will be much worse if they take milk. Take those who are sensitive to lactose. These individuals have a real problem taking a lot of milk, the quantity recommended here by the National Dairy Council. If they even take a fifth this quantity, they will be in trouble. Some school children are not able to learn so well as are others, and according to investigation done by psychologists, one of whom is Dr. Alexander Schaus, there are often difficulties in the way that the person relates to others. Antisocial behavior in children may be promoted by drinking milk. Dr. Alexander Schaus reports in his book called Diet, Crime, and Delinquency that delinquent boys consumed an average of 64 ounces of milk a day, whereas non-delinquent boys consumed only 30. Delinquent girls consumed 34 ounces of milk daily, whereas non-delinquent girls consumed only 17 ounces daily. There seems to be a growing concern among those in penal institutions that the diet, especially milk, sugary junk foods, and some other improper foods fed to children when they're growing up, may be a cause of antisocial behavior, such as delinquency. We may have time to have a bit more on that a little bit later. Let's turn right now to page 8. On page 8, you will see that leukemia incidence is higher in cattle country. Leukemia and solid cancers, breast cancer and bowel cancer, these are less in vegetarians. The IQ is certainly not adversely influenced by a vegetarian diet. Notice at the top of the second column, children thrive on a vegetarian diet, and it is compatible with above average mental development. That comes from the Journal of the American Dietetic Association for February 1980. Vegetarian children do not suffer either in health or in mental development by taking a vegetarian diet. Also on page 8, you will see that diabetes is less common in vegetarians. And interestingly enough, vegetarians usually keep their teeth into advanced old age. That is another plus of the vegetarian diet. If all these things were not plenty adequate, the next item would be, and that is how to feed a hungry world on a meat-based diet. We're getting into more and more difficulty with our meat and milk and egg-based diet because of its very expense. We're having more and more hungry mouths to feed every year, and this makes it difficult to do on the diet that Westerners have become accustomed. So we're recommending to everybody that they take a second look at a meat, milk, eggs-based diet, and instead of emphasizing these foods, learn how to balance the diet without using any of them. Seventh-day Adventists have taught for over 100 years that we should teach people everywhere in our cooking schools, teach people how to cook without using milk or eggs, since the time would come when it would not be safe to use any of those. My personal opinion is that that time has already come, and we believe that if anyone will do the investigation that my husband and I have done in this matter of diseases in animals and the association that their disease has with human disease, that everyone will come to the conclusion that based on the scientific evidence now available, it is time to consider that there is no safety in using animal products in the diet. One may elect to continue to use animal products, but it is not safe. Now, would you turn to page 36? If we are not going to use so much in the way of animal products, we will probably be wanting to use a lot more grains. And I would like to talk with you a bit about the subject of the cooking of grains. Over 100 years ago, Seventh-day Adventists began to teach that one should cook grains that are cooked on top of the stove, should cook them for several hours. We wondered, when we first read this, how long is several hours? So we put four pots on to boil, corn grits, of course, rice, rolled oats, cracked wheat, and whole kernel wheat. We found that everything except rolled oats required 2.5 to 3 hours to cook them until they're entirely done. You will see three diagrams on page 36. These three diagrams come from a standard nutrition textbook, Bogert, Briggs, and Calloway. And you will see raw starch, partly cooked starch, and thoroughly cooked starch, item C. We should not take grains or Irish potatoes, white potatoes, until they look like diagram C. So all you have to do is just to take a sample of your grains or potatoes and put it under the microscope and take a look at it. When it looks like diagram C, it will be done. And I can see by the look on your faces that most of you don't have a microscope as part of your standard equipment in your kitchen. But I do, so you'll probably have to accept my word for it. When we checked out the various grains that I mentioned, we found that the hydrolysis of starch did not occur until we had cooked the grains 2.5 to 3 hours, except for rolled oats, and they were done in 60 to 90 minutes. In 60 to 90 minutes, you will have a very good quality, very good tasting dish of rolled oats. All grains taste much better when they've been cooked a long time. About the same time that we did this research at Uchi Pines, some research was published in Medical Tribune on the very front page. They had fed rats incompletely cooked potato starch and found that the potato starch did not pass out of the intestinal tract undigested, which had always been taught by nutritionists that the reason we should not take raw starch, raw potato starch, and raw grains was because of the fact it would pass through the intestinal tract and take with it other nutrients. It does do that. But one of the big reasons why we should not take grains or white potatoes raw is the fact that it can pass into the bloodstream and go throughout the body and turn up in such places as joints, the brain, the pancreas, and other solid organs. The researchers who did this work found starch granules plugging the blood vessels in the brain. These starch granules would plug up the blood vessels for days until an inflammatory exudate surrounded the little starch granule and through the enzymes made from white blood cells that made the inflammatory exudate, until these enzymes helped to dissolve the starch granule, the little artery or vein or the capillaries would be plugged up by the incompletely cooked starch. The researchers postulated that in humans, this would result in headaches, dizziness, ringing in the ears, head noises of various kinds, sinking feelings and unearthly feelings that some people occasionally feel for a few seconds, as well as allergies and joint pains and gastrointestinal upsets. So since that time, we have been recommending to people that grains be cooked the night before for breakfast, or if you're going to serve rice for lunch, that it be put on at the time you finish with breakfast and cook it most of the morning. Now, probably some of you have questions. If you do, I'd be happy to hear your questions now. Question here. All right. Question is about the vitamin content of grains after they have been cooked for several hours or overnight, and it is perfectly proper for you to cook grains in a slow cooker overnight. It is an interesting thing that vitamin losses, there are some tender vitamins that are lost by cooking of grains, but the interesting thing is that such vitamins as thiamine, which is a tender vitamin and is lost in the cooking of grains, such a vitamin, most of the vitamin is lost during the first 30 minutes of the cooking process. Well, you're going to be cooking grains under any circumstances that long, so most of your losses are going to occur at that time. And then the loss levels out so that by the end of the cooking time, 2.5 to 3 hours, you're hardly losing any more than you lost during the first half an hour. That was my first question, too, when I read this statement that Adventists had taught for over 100 years. You still have plenty of thiamine left, so that grains are still a sizable source of thiamine, riboflavin, and other B vitamins. Other questions? Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. Potatoes, the question is, for grains, several hours, but what about for potatoes? Potatoes, you can tell by how it looks and how it tastes if it is done. You can't tell that for grains. Grains look done, taste done, smell done, hours before they are done. It was for this reason that Adventists began to teach, cook your grains several hours if they're cooked on top of the stove as mush. This was quite a service to the world that Adventists did to help people know how long to cook their grains. Yes. All right, let's say you're going to cook rice. Question is about how much water to use with grains if you're going to cook them for a long period. Let's take rice. 1 cup of rice, ordinarily, the instructions will tell you 30 minutes with 2 cups of water for 1 cup of rice. But if you're going to cook it for 2.5 to 3 hours or overnight, you will need 2.5 to 3 cups, depending on how long you do cook it. 1 cup of rice, 2.5 to 3 cups, depending on the length of time. If you cook it overnight, you may need the 3 cups. If you cook it only 2.5 to 3 hours, you should cook it just at a bare boil, and that won't cook off a lot of extra water. Question. All right, the question is about such grains as rice. In using a steamer or cooking it in the water itself, and the answer is no, the time is about the same. The result is also about the same. Any other questions? Yes. For working people? No, let me tell you. This is what you should do. If you're a working person, as I am, what you should do is the night before, put your grains on. you will find, if you start doing this, that you will spend less time by about one-third of the time that you ordinarily spend cooking grains, you will spend it. Now, the cooking time is much longer, but the cook's time is about a third the length of time that she is going to be spending if she cooks rice or oats in the way that I tell you to. All you have to do is to measure out the water and the rice. Put it on and don't touch it. Don't open the lid. Most women look at it, stir it, they check the water, they spend a good bit of time with it. But if you will do just as we tell you to, you will spend less time with it. Doesn't take much time anyway. The stove is going to do all that that requires time. And your time will be less than it used to be. Then in the morning, if you use a slow cooker or if you use a double boiler, just take the pot. If it's a slow cooker, set the whole thing on the table. Most of the slow cookers are designed for serving in also, so your total time is less than the old way. All right, the pre-cooked oats, like quick oats, these oats require 35 to 45 minutes of cooking time. They are not done in the 1 to 5 minutes that the label tells you is the cooking time. That's right. It's unhelpful for us to eat these grains improperly cooked. Many of the allergies that infants suffer from are due to improperly cooked grains. Many of the allergies that adults suffer from are due to improperly cooked grains. The commonest chronic illness in the United States today is that of allergies. Many allergies come to us because of improperly cooked grains. When the immune system is injured by improperly cooked grains, I believe that it encourages the production of other allergies. Question. All right. What about anything cooked in the oven? That's a good question. Almost everybody begins to feel uncomfortable about things that are cooked in the oven. But when you cook something in the oven, the browning reaction, which is an enzymatic reaction, releases enzymes that very rapidly cause the same thing that heat and water will do on top of the stove. So it's a difference in the cooking technique. When you bake, the Maillard reaction or the browning reaction greatly shortens your cooking time once browning occurs. When you make waffles, don't make them so that they are pale. Make waffles so that they are tanned a little bit. Now, what about making... That's right, but the enzyme goes all the way through the bread loaf. So the release of the enzyme from the browning reaction allows the enzyme to make the grains done all the way through the bread. Same thing is true with granola, waffles, French toast, and the like. These can be cooked very rapidly if they are browned. Now, what about overbrowning? Dark toast and scorched food increase your risk of getting cancer. Dr. Bruce Ames, who is a very prominent doctor in cancer circles, he is from Berkeley, University of California. Dr. Bruce Ames, for whom a cancer test is named, the so-called Ames test for cancer, Dr. Bruce Ames reports that scorched food increases your risk of getting cancer. In fact, Dr. Bruce Ames has a list of foods that he likes to give to good foods and bad foods. What do you suppose Dr. Ames has in his list of good foods that will protect you against cancer? He has three. What do you suppose they are? Fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. I'm sure you would not, you would know that I wouldn't present it if it wouldn't support my thesis. What do you suppose he has in the bad for you group? Number one is animal products, meat, milk, eggs, and cheese. In fact, this is being written about more and more recently. Perhaps I have here something that might tell more about that. Just from Loma Linda University this past year, in earlier in 1984, in a very prestigious journal, the American Journal of Epidemiology, Dr. David Snowden and Dr. Roland Phillips, as well as Dr. Warren Choi, published an article called Diet, Obesity, and the Risk of Fatal Prostate Cancer. And so far as the diet is concerned, other than a diet that causes obesity, which does increase the risk of cancer of the prostate, the diet is that as you add each item from the animal kingdom to the diet, the risk of fatal prostate cancer goes up. Milk, cheese, eggs, and meat, as each of these is added. Some very interesting research is now being done to show that, just as Dr. Bruce Ames says, things from the animal kingdom are more and more associated with the problem of cancer. What do you suppose Dr. Bruce Ames put as second on his list? Smoking comes way up here. That's above everything else. Tension is also a factor, but let's just stick to dietary matters. In the diet, what do you suppose he had in his list of foods? Item number two. Number one was animal products. Number two, anybody care to guess? Sugar was down the list a little way. Number two is coffee, tea, colas, and chocolate. Number three is burnt toast and other scorched foods. Then number four was all of the refined products, sugar, white flour, all of the refined products. And apparently, refined proteins and refined fats also come very high on the list. The National Academy of Sciences put fats as number one, but then quickly pointed out that the commonest source of fats in the United States is animal products, meat, milk, eggs, and cheese. Dr. Ames, after he lists the refined foods, gets to his next item, and that is mushrooms. Mushrooms have two substances in them, hydrazine and benzene diazonium, both of two related compounds, both of which are cancer-producing agents. Dr. Ames also lists damaged potatoes. Now, damaged potatoes would be those potatoes that have been injured by the digging tool, such as a hoe. If the potato is damaged and several days pass before the potato is used, the potato develops its own pesticide and insecticide, and this substance is toxic to a human being. Toxic so that it increases one's risk of getting cancer. So if you should injure a potato in digging it, you should eat that right away, not save it at all until the development of this cancer-producing agent. Another thing that makes potatoes unhelpful for us is that of greening of the potato. Greening of the skin of the potato is an indication that it should be thrown away. So is an injury in a potato several days old. Don't trim it and expect to eat what is left and that it will be all right. Just throw the potato away. If you don't feel good about throwing it away, then bury it in your flower bed or in your garden so that it will form compost for the next potatoes that you grow. But don't eat it. Now, are there other questions about grains that before we leave that subject? Yes. Pressure cooking, that's a good question. Pressure cooking will reduce the cooking time significantly of grains. Rice, 55 to 60 minutes at 5 pounds pressure. Okay, other questions? Yes. All right, microwave. So far as I know, no tests have been done in boiling grains in the microwave. Bread has been tested. We have tested bread prepared in a microwave or baked in an ordinary convection oven. We can tell no difference in the finished product so far as looking at it under the microscope is concerned. Whether there are substances that accumulate in any food prepared in a microwave, I feel, has not been established. And I have a bit of concern about individuals who prepare all their foods with microwaves. I think before we endorse the microwave, we should have more time to elapse before we say that it is totally without any kind of problem for us. Some of you, as I have lived through many different dispensations of modern medicine. And we have seen such things as sonography and X-ray and other things that were at first declared to be totally harmless, to come to the point where we are now saying that sonography should not be used except when it is absolutely essential. I remember when sonography first came to the University of Alabama in the Department of Obstetrics, it was considered to be a toy. And every woman who came into the department was shown her little baby, shown the hands and the head and other parts of the body. While we were training the probe all around over the baby. Of course, that kind of thing is not done now. Now the sonography is done as quickly as it can be, and a great deal of play of the probe over the baby is not done. We do know that sonography does influence the baby and that babies do react to it. And some obstetricians are saying that no sonography should be done except that will substantially alter the treatment of the mother if the sonography is not done. Isn't anyone going to ask me about what you will have left after you have cooked rice for 2.5 to 3 hours? Won't it be one big, soggy, gummy, inedible mess of porridge? It does very nicely. You would be very surprised at how nicely it does. Let me tell you a little technique in cooking that can help you to have the nicest rice you have ever had. Just take a skillet, put the dry raw rice in the skillet. Stir it over medium to high heat for about 2.5 to 3 minutes. At the end of that time, pour it up quickly. Pour it up into the water that you're going to cook it in, which has already been pre-measured. Don't leave it in the pot, in the skillet. If you do, this nice nutty aroma that arises from the rice while you're toasting it will turn to smoke. And then you will be violating what Dr. Bruce Ames says, and that is no scorched food. So have the water all ready Pour the rice into it as soon as it is done. If you object to the sticky quality that oatmeal has when it has been cooked, if you will toast oatmeal prior to cooking it, you will find that it will do very nicely for you. It will not develop any of the stickiness that we get when it is prepared in the ordinary way with boiling. Just toast it ahead of time, then boil it your 2.5 to 3 hours with rice or 60 to 90 minutes with oatmeal. Any other question? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Mm-hmm. But I have a question in my mind. How do you relate people who have a diet where they have a craving for food, maybe occasionally, or intermittently, whatever you want to call it, versus a continuous diet of a wrong thing? You talk about vitamins, you talk about potatoes, you talk about even sweet things and pastries.
Now, all right.
As I look at this thing, I'm trying to look at it very honestly. According to what I've heard, and all these things that I've read, I feel that I'm some kind of miracle that I'm setting their life tonight.
All right.
Okay.
Yes, I quite understand.
That I think to be tempered in our eating and drinking or whatever we do, and I'm certainly sure that the vegetarian diet is certainly the best. I didn't eat any fresh food at all after I was 20 some years old.
Yes.
And we never had it in the house. And I certainly was not in an area.
Yes.
But I don't have the desire to eat fresh food that other people have.
Very good.
I know people who go on vegetarian diet, they can hack it for 2 or 3 years, and all of a sudden, they got to go out and get a temper.
All right. Question is?
How you relate this? Now, this happened to do with the lady who's pregnant, and I'm on paper with a midnight.
Yes. All right. The question is, how do you relate yourself to people who get cravings, like a pregnant woman who wants pickles at midnight, or a person who has taken a vegetarian diet for a year or two or three and then begins to crave a steak and goes out and purchases one? How do you handle this kind of thing? Well, I'll tell you what you should do. You and everyone else, we should all put our diet under the control of conscience and reason. If you do not have a good reason for eating pickles, don't get up at midnight and eat pickles. And a pregnant woman should not get up and eat pickles in the middle of the night. Pickles are not good for the pregnant woman, nor for anyone else if they are made with vinegar. And so she should just simply decide what her diet should be based on reason. Now, this brings up a very good point, and I'm glad you brought this up, and that is that not everyone's needs are like everybody else's needs.